Okay, it's time. Is this on? Yeah, I think it is. So I've talked about process scheduling. So last few classes, it was about scheduling processes, which is just looking at it from the lens of what does the CPU do and how do we make it run multiple things. Kind of virtually at the same time, but not. It always does one thing at a time. So we talked about context switching. We talked about scheduling strategies and round robin, which is the most common base scheduling algorithm for all machines today. Now, getting ahead a little bit, is that, of course, we've kind of constantly been saying that processes run programs, and these programs are the same thing as applications. And to an OS person, everything is an application, even though it might be a utility, a systems program, things that are embedded in operating systems such as GUI or all that stuff. But okay, so these are applications. The applications are all written in some high-level language. And we think of it as the compiler produces object code, which then the processes run. And hence the object code is the object code, which is machine language code, which can be run on the CPU. That's not entirely true. And this compiler to object code generation is somewhat of a mystery, but we will look a little bit. I'm not going to teach compilers, it's not a compiler class, but I'm more interested in how does the operating system and its allied things in it take object code and run it. And there is several steps in the middle. So before you can run a process, you must have some sort of a memory image in complete machine code that can be loaded into memory and run. So where does that come from? So as an example, let's take and diagrammatically, the C program, let's say x.c, there might be two files, y.c. They get compiled, often separately, to x.o and y.o. Y.o, these are called object files. And then you have library files. And then there has to be some way of merging this into an executable file. And on Windows it's known as exe, on Linux it doesn't have really a And this thing here is linker. And then this executable file has to go to memory. And this is the loader. So the linker is really is an application, is a systems application that takes the compiler outputs and combines them somehow. And then the loader conceptually copies this to memory, but not really. There's a whole bunch of things that happen both at the link stage and at the load stage that needs a little bit of looking at, because this is important as to how low-level things work in a computer. We are used to writing C programs or Java programs. Java programs work completely differently. But we are used to writing programs in some language, compiling them, and then it just automatically becomes a file, and you just run that file, and off it goes. No, there's a bunch of hidden stuff in there. Okay? So if you take a look at a very simple C program, obviously, this program that I wrote does nothing other than print hello, and the variable is just a dummy. How would I compile this? If I knew how to compile and I knew all about assembly code, which is not really the same as machine code, how will I compile this? Conceptually, I would have to say something like main starts here. But starts here, nothing exists on computer language object code that says starts here. This has to be somehow expressed as an address. And at this point, all the compiler is an application process that can read this and understand it, but what address? No idea. That's where the problems start. Then I have to store the number 0, immediate 0, into I. No, you cannot have I. There's no symbolic stuff on computer machine language. This has to be an address. Then you have to load that. Okay, you have to do something, increment I. Then you've got to do this printf. So that'll be a there's too many mysteries here. How can a compiler do this? It doesn't know what the address location of I is. It can assign it an address location, but that may not be true because it's going to be loaded by a loader into memory. Where in memory? Unknown at this point. At compile time, you don't know where it's going to go in memory. And different operating systems choose different starting points or even different versions of the operating system changes these addresses around. So you have no idea where main starts, you don't know where this variable I is. How do I can copy hello into some memory locations if I know the addresses of memory locations, but that again is the same problem. Then I want to call printf, which is a routine, supposedly predefined. Where is it? How do I know printf is even a routine? Does the compiler know about all the external routines that are in the standard libraries? Answer is no. So we've got a whole bunch of problems here. So the solution to this is called generating relocatable code with external references and symbol tables, then using a linker to get a more manageable, executable file with, again, relocatable addresses, which, again, goes through a loader which really patches up all the addresses. So a little bit more detail on how that thing works. So stuff that you don't see, it's under the covers of every operating system, it just works. So let me call, I'll not do separate, let me call this x.c, and there is a y.c, which is some other piece of code. So when I'm generating object code, the first approach the compiler takes is that, look, I have to make some assumptions about memory addresses, because that's the whole thing, is just memory address and moving load and store to memory addresses. So I'm going to assume this little file x.c starts at memory location 0. That's wrong, but I'll make a wrong assumption. I will place this variable that was declared as global in the memory location address 0, because that's where it starts. And then starting address 1, I'll put this string which has hello in it. And then I will do all my loads and stores with the appropriate addresses that are in this address space. The whole thing's a fiction, but at least it's there. Now, I'm going to call a routine called printf, and that I cannot. I just put the words printf here. And that won't work, but I do that. And then I create a actually, external references work a little different. So I compile into some code that kind of looks like executable. It's got addresses in there, it's got strings in there, it's got opcodes in there. But there are some mistakes here. The addresses are wrong, and there's some external references which are wrong. I create an internal reference table where it says that there is a symbol, this is part of the symbol table, that there is a symbol called I, which is located at 0 in my case, in case somebody externally calls that. There is a string somewhere which is located at 1 because I put it there. And then, in addition, all the addresses in the addresses in the code that's generated is flagged with something known as relocation bits. That here are the addresses it's referring to, these are not correct. There are flags there saying these numbers need to be fixed. Okay? And that's how you generate object code. There's symbol tables, there's relocation bits, there is cooked up addresses, and it's kind of a half-baked job that hopefully can be fixed up later. Now you take the Linux linker is called LD for loader. It's a misnomer. It's not a loader. It's a linker. It takes all the files from the let's say, the C library, at least the files written by the user and all the other libraries that this program references and picks these files up, reads them, and does something. This something is, it firstly knows that all of these start at memory location zero. So that's not good. I'm going to create an executable where x.o goes into memory location 0. y.o goes into memory location, let's say, 105. And the library goes into some memory location 300. Now, wherever there is a load of 0 with relocation flag on, I can now leave it alone because it's the first one, 0 is correct. If there is a load of 0 with a relocation flag on, then I change the 0 to 105 and I leave the relocation flag. If there is a call to 0, I look at the external reference table and notice that it's 0 and it's printf. I find printf somewhere here in its internal reference table. And I know printf is at the memory location 350, so I change this 0 to 350 as well as add a relocation flag to this. So I am now connecting all the internal and external references of these things correctly with a relocated address because I'm changing the starting point of these little modules. And I'm patching, so I have two tables per compiled program, including the library. The library defines what it actually contains and where they start, which is in the internal reference table. The other programs define what external references they have. Some of them are implicit, but they get resolved at the link time. So if you make mistakes, the linker will complain that something is an undefined symbol at this point. Okay? But what's wrong here is that this is all assuming it starts at memory location 0, which may not be true. So I'll just kind of write this down. What does an object file contain? It is not something that can be run. Things that can be run contain only opcodes and addresses and system calls. That's it. There should be nothing else in there. No names, symbols, strings of names or whatever. And all addresses must be absolute addresses and correct. Okay? That's what a real executable in memory looks like. That cannot be achieved at the compiler stage. So compiler creates some thing called an object file, which contains addresses and opcodes, pretty much like what would be actually loaded in memory, but the addresses are wrong. It contains external references like call this address or load this address. that is undefined at this point, because you can be referencing external variables in another file, or you can be referencing external functions. You've worked with external functions and variables, I'm sure, if you know about the C language, or even Java does that. So these external references are tagged with an index number. It does not put the whole string name over there. It takes too much space. It is tagged with an index number that this is an external reference that I have not resolved at this point. Then it creates two tables. One is all the symbols that are used here. By symbols are names, function names, variable names, etc., that are defined here, and where they are relative to the starting address of this this particular object file, which is zero. It creates an external reference table which contains the names of all these things I'm trying to access, which I don't have, along with their index numbers. That instead of calling it printf, I'm calling it zero. Instead of calling it some other average function, I'm calling it one. So at various points here, I'm using external reference zero, external reference one. In the external reference table, I resolve that these numbers are really these large names. I'm storing the large name once instead of scattered all over the place. The linker's job is to take all of this and create a file that is much more sensible. This is what the compiler generates. So the linker essentially gets rid of all the external references. They have been resolved. We found it in various tables, know the relative addresses. The linker also resolves the fact that everything is not starting at zero. We're going to lay it out in some layout, one after the other, recalculate all the addresses, and put that recalculated addresses in there. But I'll still keep relocation bits on addresses, saying these addresses may not be correct either. So it cleans out all the compiler-generated junk. I am oversimplifying things. There is the concept of data segments, stack segments, heap segments, and they are coalesced in different ways. I'm not getting there. It just gets too complicated to explain. If you think about it, you might get it. So I'm just mishmashing all the code data segments in here and creating a big chunk, which is almost runnable code. Why won't this run? Any idea why? Yeah?
Because the address is still zero.
Because the addresses are not zero. The assumption is it starts at zero. So all the addresses are wrong. They're off by a constant. Because if I might start it at 2000. So they'll be all off by a constant. That's number one. Number two, I'm saying there are things in there called relocation bits, right? There is no relocation bits in memory of a computer. It is very well-defined format. If you think of 230 and your MIPS machine, the address has to fit exactly here. The opcode has to fit exactly here. There might be an immediate this. It's very clearly laid out, and it has very little information other than here's the opcode, here's the address, go for it. There's no relocation bits. So this format is wrong because it has bits in various places that there is no space for in memory, and you've got to weed those things out. If you load them into memory, it's a jumble. The CPU won't understand what these bits are. So those two reasons, this cannot be run, but it's easy to fix now. The loader, now the compiler is an application program. You can run a compiler. The linker is an application program. You can run a linker. You can run a compiler by typing in GCC or G++ or whatever. You can do a command line. You can give it an option which says just leave it in the object file. Don't run the linker. It automatically runs the linker. Then you can do an LD with all these objects files and create an executable file. The loader is not a program. The loader is something magical built into the kernel, and it gets called by a system call, so it's just a function in the kernel. Why is it in the kernel? Why can't it be a program? It cannot be a program because it has to allocate memory, change memory maps, know about how to access memory. It has to be privileged. There's a bunch of privileged operations in there. So it's just put in the kernel, which is why you don't see it. It just happens. It reads from an exe file, copies most of it, so it's got an exe file which has relocation bits and starting address 0. It goes over it line by line, copies it into the code area, somehow copies the data part in the data area, and it decides that the starting point is start. So anytime it sees a relocation flag, it deletes the flag and it changes the address that the flag is tagged with by adding the base address, which is start, to that address. Okay? And that's it. And then this thing in RAM can be executed. All you need to know is where is the start address. So I shouldn't have called the top start, this should be base. That's the base address. The start address is the location where the main program starts. And the address of every function generated by a compiler is in the internal symbol table. So as it's being done, the word main is flagged as a special case. And that the linker understands and keeps that information around, that this is where the main program starts. The loader also figures out from there where the main program starts. And then the loader is able to run it. Well, the loader does a few other things. So firstly, it has to allocate memory. This allocation of memory is a privilege instruction. Copying things to memory which doesn't belong to you is a privileged instruction. So it turns off all of those memory bounds checking. It's in the kernel. It can copy to any part of memory. How does it know which memory is free? It has to have some access to the memory management tables. We haven't covered that, but there's a memory manager which has these free lists and all kinds of fancy things where it keeps track of who's using what memory. So this guy goes and finds some memory through those tables, allocates it, that means marks it already used, then copies the file into memory, stripping the relocation bits and changing the addresses. And then it creates a PCB. The PCB contains the start address, not really, it contains the stack pointer. The stack has to have the start address and some other registers in there. Remember, we pushed a bunch of registers. So we have to create a PCB which looks like this process used to run and has been interrupted at the first statement. So it has to put a bunch of information on the stack and a bunch of information in the PCB, set the base and limit registers so that the memory management works, and then put that PCB into the ready queue. And then this process will start running eventually. And that's how it works. So when you double click something, it's the loader which makes sure that that process runs. It has already been compiled and linked.
So does the loader copy the system call opcodes?
System call opcodes is the int instruction. That looks like an opcode, so it goes there. The whole system call is in the kernel. It's not getting copied. So it's just the software interrupt instruction is part of the program. The loader doesn't care.
So it still has external references?
No, the system call interrupt takes... It actually does not have an external reference. Maybe I did not. A system call on the Intel system works as like this. It loads a particular code, which is an integer, it's a number. Code is a number. Into a register, let's call it R1. And then it generates an interrupt of type 80 hex. All interrupts are numbered also. So what does this mean? This means that this interrupt will go into the interrupt handler at 80 or hex 80. And over here there will be a function which says switch get code from. So what I'm trying to get at is we don't use names for system calls. We actually, in a library, convert all names to numbers. So the system call in Unix and in the core kernel is 1234 or 0123456. And there is library stubs to convert it. So let's say I call the open system call, let's say it's 0. The code 0 will be loaded into R1. That's a temporary holder for that, and an interrupt will be generated. All system calls will run into the same function in the kernel. Everything comes into this function. It looks at the code, and if it's 0, it'll call the open routine. If it's 1, it'll call the read routine. So that's kind of a multiplexer. All system calls come here. We send you off depending upon which system call you actually want. So at this point, there is no external reference. There's a number being loaded into a register and a constant being invoked as an interrupt. Okay? Will I answer your question? So yeah, when you loaded it, there is no symbols, no references, nothing. Everything is internal, except the system calls, which is using a hack to get there. Okay, that part is not in the book, but... So I did cover something about processes create processes. Now, recapping that, processes create processes using a system call called fork, which has a number and it goes into the kernel. That kernel call will call the loader, create an address space, load everything in, and start that thing using a PCB. Processes can create threads. That's a whole different, slightly different strategy. Processes can create threads, there is no loader needed. The process creates a thread in its own space. So I don't have to allocate memory, it runs its own code. So I don't have to load any code. So thread creation is faster. Processes create threads creating processes is fork in Linux, creating threads is? Do you have any idea how to create a thread at the application level in Linux? No? Somebody must have done some threads programming. How do you create a thread? Yeah. Yes, which library? Firstly, there has to be a system call, just one system call that creates a thread. Because everything, I'll just now talk about kernel threads versus, but here we're talking about processes are created in the kernel by processes. Threads are created in the kernel by threads. There's another way of doing it, but that's not, the first one's normal. So you've got to do a kernel call.
Run?
Java. There's no run, at least not that I know of. Okay. There is a system call. It is purposely extremely hidden. Nobody is supposed to talk about it, so I shouldn't tell you what this system call is. I'll tell you, but please don't use it. Somehow there's some politics around this system call. That is, we don't want anybody to know about this system call. So don't feel bad. That system call, if you know the name, you can actually look it up, is called clone. And it's purposely poorly documented. It's not for you. So how do you start threads in Linux? And what happens? Threads in Linux is done by libraries can't do it, but library called pthread. And it's a long history of why it's called pthread, POSIX thread, that doesn't exist. In this library, there is a function called pthread create. And pthread create takes a bunch of arguments, and it does some things, and somewhere here it calls clone with a different set of arguments, and you're not supposed to know about clone. You're only supposed to use pthread create, not clone. And the argument for not using clone is a little weak. It's like, oh, this could change any time, etc., etc. Not portable, don't use it. Okay, so we can live with that. So what happens when you do clone? And one of the arguments to clone is a name of a function. So clone, you've got to give it a function name. It creates a PCB and all the initialized stack. It creates another stack. Every thread has its own stack. Every process has its own stack. So we'll talk about this thread in a minute. So it creates a PCB. It just acts like its process creation. So it is a process, except it doesn't allocate memory and it doesn't load a brand new executable in there. It reuses stuff from the parent. Okay? And this function is accessed through pthread create. I think I did talk about processes and threads. So a process is really a thread and its address space. So it has its own memory space to execute in. And the memory space consists of code, data, stack, and heap. Data is the global data. And that's where your C program goes in, and you know the global data is there, all the functions are there, which is part of the code, the main routine is there. And it also gets a thread to execute the main routine. The thread or process can create another thread in that space. If so, everything will be reused but not the stack. A brand new stack will be created for this new thread. And that stack will be placed in some hidden location in the parent's address space, but the parent's not supposed to touch that stack. It is its private stack. Why can't we share everything? This is not just somebody's whim. This has to be done that way. We we cannot share everything, because a stack sort of embodies the execution behavior of a thread of control. That sounds very fancy, but it's true. This is what goes on. I'll have to kind of do. So here is main, and let's say it's calling F1, and it has called F2, and then so this is a process. F1 goes and calls F3, which is another process, and let's do it this way. The parent thread started a new thread in F10. Okay, it continued and called F1. That continued and called F2. Now we are at F3. At this point, due to scheduling, this thread started up. And F10 called F11. And if the stack pointer is somewhere at the top of the activation thing of F3, this will put F11's return address on top of it and move the stack pointer up. Then if the parent process does a return, it'll return to here instead of there. That's a mess. We want these things to execute independently. Return addresses are stacked on the stack in the order the thread has been visiting neighboring functions, etc. Two threads have two different behaviors. They have two different sets of return address sequences. If you jumble the two up, your program won't work. They'll be jumping around, trampling over each other. That's why they have separate stacks. The control flow gets messed up. The stack is very important to control flow. Remember, in the context switching, we were just switching the stack pointer and boom, it goes somewhere else. So somebody's stack pointer should not be messed with by another thread. The kernel can mess with it based on it knowing exactly what it's doing. Okay? So till now, what the threads I've been talking about are kernel-level threads. I just introduced a new term because there's a reason for it. The threads I've been talking about are sometimes called kernel-level threads, or a bad terminology, kernel thread. Be careful. Kernel thread does not mean a thread running in the kernel or a thread belonging to the kernel. The kernel thread is an application thread that is created, maintained, and scheduled by a kernel. Big difference. In fact, what about threads that are running in the kernel or belong to the kernel? What can you say about them? Who are they? Threads that run in the kernel or belong to the kernel?
Interrupt handler.
Okay. The two answers to the first part. Thread running in the kernel. Either you can say there's no such thing, or you can say every thread runs in the kernel when it's hit by an interrupt and becomes an interrupt handler. So the interrupt handler is a thread running in the kernel, but this thread is stolen from an application. It is not a dedicated thread that runs in the kernel. Every application thread occasionally dips into the kernel because of interrupt call, because it executes interrupt handlers or system calls. There's no dedicated kernel thread. There is no thread that belongs to the kernel. There's no thread running in the kernel all the time. There are multiple threads that enter the kernel, sometimes all at the same time, and execute in the kernel. But these are all application threads. Okay? So when you say kernel threads, this is just a quirk of terminology. It's a thread, a user-level thread running in a process which was created by the kernel, and that's how threads get created. So all threads are kernel threads. Well, that's not true. Not all threads are kernel threads. But if the thread is created like I talked about, clone, pthreads, those things are kernel threads. Java threads, those are kernel threads. And murking the waters further, some people talk about user threads. All threads are user threads. No, this is a different thing. There is a user level thread. I don't know how to explain this. You see, a process is a memory address space and a virtualization of the CPU. So the next step in thinking, if you think about it, why isn't the process a CPU? If the process is a CPU, why can't I write a kind of an operating system for this process so that this process pretends to be a kernel and starts running threads? Or processes, sub-processes, in its own address space, managed by itself using a scheduler that it has built, and pretend it's running an operating system. And the answer is yes, it can be done, and it's rather simple to do. And that is called a user-level thread, whereas a process runs as one single process, creates threads within its address space without telling the kernel. The kernel does not know of the existence of these threads. The kernel scheduler only schedules the process, not the threads. There is no PCBs in the kernel for the threads. They are all in the process. And that's what a user thread is. So why complicate life by doing this? That's a different story. We like to play games with our computers. Okay? So this can be done. There are serious advantages and serious disadvantages of it. By today's standards, there are more disadvantages than advantages. So it's becoming something that's not very used. The disadvantages are essentially that since you're using one process, all threads do not get time sliced. How do I say this? Different threads cannot use different cores of the system. They all run on one core because a process runs on one core and the operating system only thinks it's one process. And if the process blocks, all threads block. Whereas in kernel threads, every thread is independent. They can do whatever they want as long as they properly share the address space. Okay? Yeah.
Is containerization an example for user-level threads?
I don't know. Containerization?
Like Docker?
No. You're talking about software that fits or plugins and things like that. Or some sort of dynamic linking. I don't know. We're using different terminology. User-level threads, pthreads used to be user-level threads. Now it's kernel-level threads. Windows has a package called Fibers, which is user-level threads. Linux may have some, but kind of fallen out of favor. Why do I even bring it up? A, it's interesting. B, that's what your project's about. Build some threads. Write an operating system inside a process. Okay? So we'll get there. Yes, you'll have to do a scheduler, you'll have to do scheduling queues, you have to context switch processes around without messing with the kernel. So let's take a look at two functions, and doesn't matter user level, kernel level. Let's think of kernel level threads. I'm using pthreads or create thread, which is the Windows system call, to create threads. One thread runs in F1, one thread runs in F2. Okay? Now, I throw in a loop here. Let's say I throw in an infinite loop. And here I define an integer j. Here I define an integer j. And here I define an integer I equals 0. In that loop, I do a j plus plus, I plus plus, print f1 ij. So what's going on? I'm printing F1 and F2 just to say where I am, otherwise it gets confusing. So whenever this guy runs, it prints F1, and it prints the value of I, prints the value of J. This guy prints the string F2, prints the value of I, prints the value of J. What will be the output if I run this? Anybody has any questions about this? Do you understand how this might work? If I did not start two threads, I started one thread, what will be in F1, what will be the output? Oh, I should probably... Okay, so I run a thread in F1. What output will I see printed? It's an infinite loop, but what's going to... So it's going to print a lot of things. What are these things? Yeah.
Variable I and j.
Be more specific.
1, 1.
1, 1. Okay. F1, 1, 1. And then? F1, 2, 2. Right? F1, 3, 3. F1, 3, 4. I'm 4, 4. So that's if one thread. What if I ran two threads? Yeah.
Well, I got a question. Are these threads parallel to each other?
Threads run something like simultaneously. If let's say I have only one CPU, one core machine. If it's a two core machine, it's definitely parallel. If it's a one core machine, it cannot be parallel. But they seem to run parallel, like I showed you those looping programs that keep on running simultaneously. So everything runs together. And there is the magic soup is the kernel, the magic soup is the scheduler, which is switching them around. So if I start two threads, they will both execute seemingly at the same time.
So it should just be, if it's the exact same code, then it should just be the exact same output, meaning 1, 1, 2, 2, right?
Yeah, but the label's different. It's... using F2, so it has F2 embedded in it.
Yeah.
So, one possibility you're saying is it'll be... Will it be interspersed? So it'll be F2, 1, 1, F2, 2, 2, F2, 2, 3. That's one possibility, okay? Yeah.
Since I is a shared variable, there might be a race condition.
There might be a race condition, okay? Since we haven't talked about race condition, let's just ignore the race condition bit. What will you see if there was no race? There might be a race condition, there might not be a race condition. If so happens that there's no race condition, what happens? Okay, what will it be?
It will be F1, 1, 1,
mm-hmm.
F2, 2, 1, because I would have two steps, two increments, and on 1.
Okay, keep going. Is that possible? In fact, this both going exactly the same is can happen in an obscure case, but most likely this will not happen. Most likely that will happen. That is, at every print, I gets incremented once and J does not. J gets incremented by F. J gets the two copies of J, one for F1, one for F2. Okay? And so F1 increments its own J, F2 increments its own J. So every time F1 runs, J gets incremented. And every time anybody goes through the loop, I gets incremented. So I will go fast, twice as fast. In fact, it could be worse. It could be nobody said they had to alternate. Who decides when they run? The scheduler. We have no control over the scheduler. Scheduler is kind of the enemy. It messes things up. I wanted to run F1, F2, F3 like that, but F1, F2, F1, F2, F1, F2, but most likely that's not going to happen. It'll be some bunches of F1 and some bunches of F2 somehow. And even worse can happen, but this is a possibility. And this assumes there are no race conditions. I'll tell you what a race condition is, which makes it much worse. Okay, so now that I have so many possible runs, this is intractable. I can't predict what this program's going to do because there's too many possibilities. Yeah, it might do this, it might do that. It might do something else too, and I'll show you how the something else is. So how do we control the behavior of threads? And that's a major thing that we want to talk about here.
Could you pause them?
I could pause them by writing a pause or sleep in it, but most times I don't want to. Or I want controlled pausing of some sort.
Thread priority?
Thread priorities, if I give a one thread higher priority, only that one would run. The other one wouldn't. Then I might as well just run one thread. Yeah.
Can you put locks on the method?
Okay, we'll have to get to locks. We haven't gotten there yet. But locks... good thing you mentioned locks. There are things called locks and stuff. Our problem is... we cannot assume anything. This is an operating systems class. So if you want to use a lock, you've got to build it. Lock is a reasonably difficult thing to build. And as an operating systems, that provides the functionality. So if lock, what is it and how do we build it? And the thing is that to build a lock, you need a lock. I'm not joking. And so that becomes kind of hairy, which is what we are going to do. Now, finally, race condition, which I did not get into. So I have two threads, one doing X++, one doing X++, and this is two threads. And for our purposes, let's say we are going to set the value of X as 0. If both threads execute at some speed and somehow come here, we can't control the speed of these threads. But depending upon circumstances, there are. So I'm not even interested in knowing who increments first. What would the final value be of X? What would you expect or want the final value to be? Pardon? I can't hear you.
Two.
So if it was two, it would be good. Two threads incremented X. It should be two. Trouble with threads is it doesn't have to be two. it may be 1. So that makes it impossible to program with. I want both threads to increment a counter, not necessarily together. I'm writing two completely separate functions, but they both increment a counter. Am I guaranteed that the counter will be incremented correctly? No. Why not? Because there is no such thing as X plus plus in any computer invented today. X plus plus is an increment of a memory location. Memory does not compute. CPUs compute. So X plus 1, depending upon machine, will get... Yes, we have to talk assembly. Load into R1 or R2 whatever is contained in the memory location X. Increment R1. Because only register values you can do arithmetic on. You cannot do arithmetic in memory. Then you've got to store the resulting value of R1 into X. And thread 1 does this. And thread 2 does it at the same time or similar times. And let's say I have one single CPU. So this guy executes the first. I get the value 0 loaded into R1. This guy gets executed second. I get the value 1 in R1. This guy gets done the third, and I get 0 in R1. Oh, did it clobber the 1 in R1? No. All CPU registers are saved when there's a context switch. So there was a context switch from here to there. So there are two separate R1s. So that one is still safe. It loaded 0 into this R1. Then it did, so this happened 2. So it went there. Then it did this guy, 4. So 1 got loaded. Then it got this guy. So 1 got into X. Then we execute 6th. We put 1 in X. The answer is X is equal to 1. This is called a race condition. 2 increments become 1 increment. So we've got to deal with this can of worms, and we're going to get to locking, synchronization, all kinds of things, and how to build those things to make sure I can write programs using threads. This is not a threads programming class. Everything in the kernel is a shared thread. So operating systems are just swamped with this problem. That wouldn't matter. It would be the same code. Yeah, because you take X plus plus, you're adding... In fact, X plus 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 X is the same thing. Only when you're assigning it, it might be different.
Okay.
On the class web page?
Okay, on the personal page.
You go to my homepage, it's linked in there, and you go to my homepage using Google with my name on. That's it.
I mean, there has a new link there.
It says homework in the class homepage. Homework one, yeah. Oh.
I just have a question about the homework.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's two questions, and then it seems like there's multiple choice for
no,
one.
No, there's a mistake
here.
Yeah, that's just two questions in
okay,
two.
So
that's
this
one,
first.
This one first, and then which should be, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Cool.
I literally,
Yeah, there's something to do with these threads, the F1 and the F2.
What?
Can you show me the functions on the slides? What you drew up? Wait, those? Oh. That's an infinite loop, right?
Yeah.
Oh.
Oh, yeah, that's two infinite loops.
So increment j, then increment I, right?
Mm-hmm. No, it's not that. So these are really.
Is that a 2 or 3?
Which? I just did up till here with the orange, then it'll all change.
F1, 3, 3, F2.
This will be 5, this will be 6, this will be 7.
Okay. This was originally like 2, 3 or something?
Oh no, that should have been 3, 3.
Oh,
okay. Yeah.
No, 55 is going to be... That's just...